You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of August 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Clemency Burton-Hill and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with Geoffrey Kaufman, ABC's London correspondent. Geoffrey, what have you got for us today?
Well, as we have so many days this month, the topic today is Syria and Egypt and the wilting of the Arab Spring. Mubarak, virtually a free man, and what to do about that chemical weapons attack in Syria.
Well, after that, we'll be heading to Italy, where Silvio Berlusconi's conviction is finally sinking in, and the coalition government is on the brink of sinking over the former president's political fate.
Plus, why the motto of Austin, Texas may be about to change from Keep Austin Weird to Keep Austin Cool.
There are great restaurants, great bars, beautiful hotels like the Haywood Hotel, and really cool shops and boutiques.
And we'll find out how the tiny medieval town of Saint-Pré in Switzerland is shaking up the world of classical music with its unbelievably inventive programming.
All of that plus, we will speak to our woman in Mali, we'll take a look at the British press, we might even play some music too if you're good. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
It's 1 minute past eight here in London. We have a very packed show as always for you this morning. But first, let's catch up on the news headlines from around the world with Paul Osborne.
The UN Secretary General says Syria must cooperate with investigations into reports of an attack with chemical weapons on the outskirts of Damascus. A UN team is in the city, but it's not clear if it will be allowed to visit the scene. Opposition activists claim that more than 1,400 people died in Wednesday's strike, and Ban Ki-moon says any use of toxic agents would be a violation of international law. George Netto is a doctor who speaks for the opposition's Syrian National Council.
67% of these are women and children, so two-thirds of these are women and children, not surprisingly, given that it happened at night where everybody was sleeping, families were sleeping. We still have houses that we have not reached.
Syrian officials say that claims of a chemical attack are illogical and fabricated. But Charles Dulfer, who's a former U.S. weapons investigator in Iraq, says the footage from the scene looks convincing.
Clearly something that hasn't been faked. I mean, these are real people. You couldn't create this. You know, there are some international parties that say, well, this could be something created, a provocation, in the words of the Russian foreign minister. That's not a convincing position.
Israel has carried out airstrikes on a target in Lebanon, just south of the capital, Beirut. It says it attacked a terror site the day after missiles were launched from Lebanon into Israeli territory. 35 people have been arrested in the Indian city of Mumbai after a woman was raped by a group of five men. The 23-year-old photojournalist was working in the city when she was attacked. A man who was with her was beaten. The trial of Bo Xilai, the former senior official in China's Communist Party, is continuing for a second day. Mr. Bo is accused of bribery, corruption, and abuse of power. Yesterday, he told the hearing that he did not accept bribes from businessmen. Foreign media are not being allowed into the trial. More protests could be staged later in Cairo by supporters of Egypt's deposed president. The Muslim Brotherhood has called for a show of strength in support of Mohamed Morsi, despite the deaths of around 900 people in the last 8 days. An American soldier has apologized for his act of cowardice, an attack on a village in Afghanistan in which 16 people died. Staff Sergeant Robert Bales has already admitted last year's attack to avoid the death penalty. He's been speaking at a military court to try to convince it to allow him the possibility of parole in 20 years' time. The families of those killed in a hostage crisis in the Philippines in 2010 are suing the country's government. Survivors from Hong Kong are also demanding an apology and compensation. It's now 3 years since a sacked Filipino policeman seized a bus packed with tourists in Manila. 8 people died and 7 were injured when police moved to end the standoff. Si Chi Kin is the brother of one of the victims.
This morning, the Philippine consulate contacted our Hong Kong government that they won't assign anyone to accept anything. So I think they're within not responsible.
Efforts are continuing to contain a huge wildfire in California. It's been burning close to the Yosemite National Park for a week, but on Thursday, the fire tripled in size. Tourists have had to be evacuated, and thousands of homes have been threatened by the fire. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Paul, thank you very much. It's almost 6 minutes past 8 in the morning here in London. You are listening to Midori House, and this is Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Ut London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House on Monocle 24. We're live from Studio One in London, and it's time now to set the day's news agenda with a couple of the day's biggest stories that you need to know about. Joining us in the studio this morning is Geoffrey Kaufman, ABC's London correspondent. A very good morning to you, Geoffrey. Thank you for being with us.
Well, good morning to you. You know, I think today's agenda may well be the main agenda for this program and for world headlines for, the next couple of decades, if not the next century. I mean, I think we really are witnessing in Egypt and Syria and the whole wilting of the Arab Spring, what may well be the defining struggle of our times. How can the Arab world reconcile its values and modernity and the struggle between, on one hand, the desire for an Islamic state and the other a desire to be part of the modern world.
Mm. Okay, well, should we jump in with Syria first up and
it's
the
really
developments
tough.
Of the last 24 hours?
You know, I don't make a habit of watching this kind of stuff. I had to do a report on it the other day, and so on Wednesday when the reports of chemical weapons broke, so I had to watch it, and it's just awful. Yeah. There are in excess of 100 videos. I mean, this is not fake stuff. I've seen it. There's not a single thing about these videos that looks anything but real. And it's horrifying. Little children, men and women, these are civilians frothing, staring blankly, dead. People struggling to keep them alive.
And not a scratch on any of their bodies.
No,
I mean, it's so
no.
eerie, isn't
right.
it? Those images
just even talking about it on the radio gives me the images come to mind. There is increasing evidence. I mean, you know, we're all scratching our heads going, well, what more evidence do you need? Obviously, in the international community, you don't want to get ahead of yourself and make claims that then prove to be incorrect. You have to move with caution. But It's increasingly clear this is chemical weapons. If it wasn't Assad, it was from his supporters. That's where they're hedging right now. Israel saying our intelligence says it's chemical weapons. Even they won't go as far as to say it's Assad and his people himself because it's so factionalized. It's really difficult to pinpoint the source. The question today on the agenda, what to do?
Well, Obama last year could not have been clearer. Chemical weapons use in Syria was going to be a red line that could not be crossed. That line has clearly been crossed. The UN saying today every single red line has been crossed. What do we do? What does America do? Yeah. What does the West do now? And how do we put that into how to reconcile the big issue, the vortex of our era, as you say?
And that is what's on the agenda. The UN here in Europe. The answer is there's not much can do. I mean, there's no appetite.
So we sit back and we wait for another chemical weapons attack?
You know, no, clearly that's not what we want to see. But here's the problem. You know, first of all, there's no appetite in Europe or America for another boots-on-the-ground campaign and invasion. That's simply not going to happen. And the geopolitics of Syria with Russia's support and with the very strong Syrian army and the divisions culturally within Syria, it's just not realistic. So what's left? You know, an air campaign like we saw in Libya, pretty difficult. They've got much, much stronger air defenses. It would be a really difficult thing to do.
And in any case, what do we do about Russia sitting on the Security Council and vetoing all of this?
Right. You've got Russia. You've also got these divided rebels who the opposition, who aren't angels themselves. So who exactly are you fighting for? There's talk now of a cruise missile attack or some bombardments. There may be something like that simply to say, okay, we're doing something, but it's going to have to sadly be a token. There just aren't a lot of options.
And in the meantime, we have people like Laurent Fabius, who's the French foreign minister, who's fond of drawing attention in these sort of tense international environments, coming out saying this sort of faintly cryptic thing about, essentially, if Russia isn't going to get involved, some force will have to be used. I'm not going to say what sort of force. And it raises the temperature, doesn't it?
Well it does. And exactly what are the French going to deploy? I think their aircraft carriers was mothballed some time ago. It's just not realistic. And it is the problem of our age that global politics is not, the U.S. does not dominate global politics. And that's not, that precedes Obama. I mean, Bush in many ways demonstrated the limits of American foreign policy in trying to re-engineer Iraq and Afghanistan. It didn't work. It's a problem. And this is not this agenda item is not going to be resolved over the weekend.
It certainly isn't. And I mean, we have an investigation with a limited mandate that may potentially only produce more questions rather than answers.
Well, before we move on to Egypt, just one more thought on Syria. And this is what's really incredible. Is that for months the UN has been struggling to get an inspection team into Syria. They finally got in last Sunday, 20 of them led by a Swedish chemical weapons inspector. This attack took place 15 to 20 minutes from where they were staying in Damascus while they were there. You can't in any logic think that Assad would say, let's unleash chemical weapons while after months of avoiding it, we finally allowed a UN chemical weapons team into the country. I mean, it escapes any notion of logic as we understand it, but it may well be true.
But it's also a spectacular double bluff if he did, because it had everyone saying, and including the Russians making that point. And if, it may well be true, as you say, or it looks as if it's not him, it's allies of him. So, but it's a wonderful cover, isn't it? It's a wonderful...
And now, of course, the push is they were allowed in to inspect claims of chemical weapon use in the north around the city of Aleppo some months ago, and that's where they're headed. Having spent a lot of time in doing this kind of reporting, I can tell you, you don't just hop in your car and say, well, then let's divert and go to the suburbs of Damascus. You've got handlers, you've got military escorts. You go where they let you go. Mm-hmm. And so they, it has to go all the way up to Assad and the head of the military for them to get clearance to go to the suburbs of Damascus to look at the evidence. But they're, they're burying the bodies as they need to, of course, because there's no electricity and the bodies are rotting. But the evidence goes with them. And so every day that passes leaves less and less evidence for them to examine.
So the likelihood of them getting anywhere near the site of the attack very soon.
That's what's on our agenda for today and through the weekend to see whether they do. I remain extremely skeptical. But let's switch now a little further south to Egypt. Who would have believed Hosni Mubarak, almost a free man under house arrest?
We wouldn't have thought this would be on our agenda 2 years ago, would we?
Incredible. I know, Arab Spring, you can just see the spring flowers wilting. It's just crushing to see that what's old is new again. I just wonder whether he's going to be in power again.
I mean, it did cross my mind.
Could that happen? I mean, this is just horrifying. Today, Friday, day of prayer, when prayers are over, traditionally, we see violence. There is the what's left of the Muslim Brotherhood is enraged. And so we should be watching today for more violence on the streets of Cairo. I was in Cairo just a couple of weeks ago before I went on vacation after the first shooting. And let me make an observation. I was in Cairo as a tourist in the 80s, and I was in Bangkok as a tourist in the 80s. And earlier this year, I went back to Thailand for the first time and was astonished by the Cairo and Bangkok back in the 80s were not that dissimilar. They were rough, ragged, dirty, developing cities that maybe had promise, but it was hard to see. Bangkok completely transformed. Modern subways, modern transportation systems, shopping malls. I mean, you can still see the old city, but you get the sense that this is a city surging into the 21st century. And it occurred to me when I was back in Egypt, in Cairo a couple of weeks ago, nothing has changed in a quarter century. In fact, the infrastructure is all falling apart. Even the so-called wealthy areas are the roads are broken, the fences are broken, the light standards are broken. Not a cent has been invested in infrastructure, and that is not, you know, this is a huge country, but it has money.
That raises one of the big questions of yesterday. The EU obviously meeting to discuss what to do about aid to Egypt. You know, a huge amount of money has been pouring into Egypt from the US, from the West, from Europe.
You don't see it.
Clearly, those conditions for aid are now not being met, but they haven't. It sounds as if they haven't been being. The money hasn't been going to the right places in any case.
I guess it's been going to the military's pockets, hasn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, this is a kleptocracy. You know, the military run far more than tanks and guns. They run tourism in that country. They run a huge part of the industrial infrastructure. But remember, Egypt is, about a quarter of the population of the Arab world, 85, 90 million people. Half of the women in Egypt today are illiterate. I mean, it's astonishing with all of the aid that's gone in. Mubarak gave the people nothing. And the problem for anyone, whether it's Morsi or Mubarak or Sisi the general or someone else, is you've got a country that is so broken and the problems so systemic, you can't simply go in and say, you know, well, we'll do this and this, and, you know, you'll start to see improvements in 6 months, a year, 2 years. This is a long-term project, and it's hard to see someone with vision having the ability and people having the patience to right what is so wrong. It's the same story in Libya. It's the same story in many other countries, but the scale of Egypt makes it so challenging.
Jeffrey Kaufman, ABC's London correspondent. Always good to talk to you. Thanks for coming to see us.
Thank you.
Coming up later on the show, we'll find out why the Italian coalition government is on the brink of collapse. And a small hint, this might have something to do with the country's former president.
Whether you're in the midst of a busy business day in Europe or eating your cereal on the East Coast, The Briefing sets you up with a fast-paced mix of news and views that you won't find anywhere else.
It's a very beautiful phone, I think. It's not out till next month. That's the only phone outside of HTC at this moment.
This one I'm holding?
Yes.
No wonder we've got security.
We'll bring you the latest developments in aviation, technology, defense, retail, and media with our industry experts, a rundown of the US and Latin American papers, plus a sharp business review of the day.
It really came about with us saying, you know, this would make sense to do something that we would enjoy shopping at and kind of change the retail landscape a little bit.
So tune in to The Briefing, every day at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York.
Now, it's been 3 weeks since the Italian Supreme Court convicted Silvio Berlusconi of tax fraud, and after a period of calm, it now looks like the media mogul is in danger of doing some serious damage to the governing coalition. Berlusconi's PDL party is prepared to bring down the government if the centre-left PD pushes ahead with its plans to throw the 76-year-old out of parliament. That's according to party secretary Angelino Alfano.
Now, Berlusconi himself has approached the impasse with a characteristic rhetorical flourish. He asked, if two friends are in a boat and one throws the other overboard, whose fault is it if the boat sinks? So could this episode really make the government go under? We'll see. And to discuss it further, we're on the line now with Gianni Riotta, former editor of Il Sole 24 Ore. Gianni, good morning to you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, good morning.
First of all, we have to just make the point that this conviction took place 3 weeks ago. So why all the ructions now?
It's a game of tug of war, or if you prefer chess or poker or whatever your preferred game is. Berlusconi doesn't have actually any real advantage of crashing or sinking the boat of Letta. At the same time, he wants Letta more actively engaged in finding legal ways of protecting him and his role in politics. So he's pushing them. He's trying to, coax them in doing things that he wants them to do, like approving some special privileges or President Napolitano granting him a presidential pardon, and nothing of this will happen. At the same time, why is, as you asked, why is Berlusconi not, is rocking a boat but is not sinking it? Because he doesn't have any real advantage in sinking Mr. Letta.
I wonder, it's not exactly economically the most, if we carry on the water metaphor, it's not the most stable waters economically for Italy at the moment. Presumably there are going to be some who feel it's not the right time to be creating instability like this, and they might end up blaming him and his cohorts.
And this is the second game, the blame game, because of course Italians know that things are going slightly better. The 2014 promises to be the best year in Europe since the crisis of 2008. And some of this is trickling down to Italy as well. The Italian companies are doing slightly better. The financial spread against Germany is getting better and better day after day. So Berlusconi wants to push the Democratic Party, the center-left party, to say, well, this is impossible, the coalition with Berlusconi doesn't work, we'll call for new election. And Berlusconi doesn't want to kill the cabinet himself. He wants to the blame to go to the Democratic Party. And of course, the Democratic Party is under a lot of pressure as well, because the radical militants say, how can you share the government and the cabinet with a convicted leader like Berlusconi is, while the voters understand slightly better that this is a marriage of convenience, it's not a marriage of love. And also, I spoke 2 days ago in Rimini at the Catholic meeting of the Comunione Liberazione with leaders of the both the Democratic Party and the center-right Berlusconi coalition, and they told me that should Berlusconi or the Democratic Party call for new election and for early election, President Napolitano may quit. He's threatening them behind the scene with quitting. And so the situation seems confused, but actually the option that the different players have are limited.
Well, it will be fascinating to see how this pans out, and if indeed there are early elections, what happens. We'll have to leave it there, but Gianni Rotta, former editor of Il Sole 24 Ore, thank you so much for joining us here on Midori House this morning.
All this week we've been exploring Monocle magazine's September issue, and today we turn to our edits section, where our New York bureau chief Santiago Tarditi kickstarts the Property Prospectus special issue with a love letter to East Austin.
Just before we came on air this morning, Monocle producer Daphne Denis asked him what's so great about the area.
So for the current issue of the magazine in the edit section, I went down to Austin, Texas to cover East Austin, the up-and-coming neighborhood in the city, as part of our Property Prospectus special. And I found there's a lot of energy there. There's a big bunch of young creatives taking over what used to be a mainly Hispanic neighborhood and converting it into one of the coolest places in Texas.
So, I mean, East Austin wasn't really a place that you used to go to. I mean, I remember, I've been there a couple of times, and I remember even 5 years ago, it wasn't that trendy. What has changed?
Not at all. In fact, locals only went there for cheap auto parts or looking for pawn shops or big fast food chains. And I think that mainly it was because of that a new influx of young people moved into the neighborhood, because the rent was very cheap and it was affordable. And Austin is a city that has a high employment rate, so they kept hiring people from all over the country who moved into the city but couldn't find a place to live in the already developed center. So they started searching for alternative neighborhoods, and they ended up in East Austin, where, in fact, they started building their own shops and boutiques and restaurants.
Austin's motto is keep Austin weird. What are the weirdest places that you spotted when you went there?
I think that motto is a bit outdated because I think it should be keep Austin cool, because most of the places I went to are very, very nice. As you will see in the magazine, there are great restaurants like Papitino's, for example. They serve true traditional Mexican food. There are great bars, beautiful hotels like the Haywood Hotel, and really cool shops and boutiques like Helm that make handcrafted leather boots. And one of my favorites that opened a few months ago is the Farewell Bookstore. And they specialize in zines and alternative print.
Austin is quite the Texan exception, isn't it? It's sort of the weird democratic core hub in the middle of a state that is not really that. What's the vibe there?
Everyone is more relaxed. There's most of the population there is very young. They are very much into art, design, food, and you don't see what is called the Mac mansions popping up all over Austin. You see more pitched roof houses with nice front lawns, backyards with swimming pools. It feels more like a traditional American suburb instead of that big and pretentious fashion that takes over some parts or most parts of Texas.
The story that you tell is very much a gentrification story. And I guess in gentrification stories, there's always two parts, the people who start moving into a neighborhood and the people who start being moved out of a neighborhood. What's been the reaction from people who used to live in East Austin and now may find themselves in a place that's a bit too expensive for them?
Well, when I explained to the people I interviewed I was doing a story on the neighborhood's gentrification, they would always stop me and they said, okay, well, gentrification has sometimes a negative connotation, and that's not the case here in the neighborhood, because in fact what they're trying to do is working very closely with the locals. For example, one of the guys I interviewed, Alan Gonzalez, has a lot of local staff, Mexicans, working with him in both his restaurant, Papitino's, and on the site of the Springdale Farms, where he runs a second restaurant called East Eden, in partnership with Andrew Ashmore. And when I was there, I saw that interaction very clearly. Instead of hiding inside of the houses, they try to mingle with the neighbors, standing in the front lawns and on the street. There are people selling food on bicycles, food trucks. So most of the interactions happen on the street around the neighborhood. And it's a very democratic interaction because you get affordable places to go to eat, boutiques and open spaces that are available for everyone. So people do gather around those spaces and share stories, share experiences. And most of the times it's what really develops new ideas, new businesses, or a new dish in a restaurant.
And finally, really quickly, if you were to go back to Austin soon, would you go to East Austin definitely to stay?
Yes, of course. I would love to stay at Mark Vera's house, actually, if he's listening. It's one of my favorite houses in the world, I dare to say. Although John Hart Asher's house was also very pretty, and his wife, Bonnie Everidge, cooked amazing, amazing barbecue ribs. So I would love to go back and stay with them if possible.
Sounds delicious. That was our New York Bureau Chief Santiago Tarditi talking to Monocle's Daphne Denis.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Now, in the next half hour of today's programme, we're going to head to a tiny medieval gem of a town in Switzerland, Saint-Pré, and hear how it's creating something radical as it brings together music, dance and architecture in a rather heady mix. But first, Paul Osborne's here after that pregnant pause with the news headlines.
The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has said Syria must cooperate with investigations into reports of an attack with chemical weapons on the outskirts of Damascus. A UN team is in the city, but it's still not clear if it will be allowed to visit the scene where opposition activists claim that more than 1,400 people died on Wednesday. Israel has carried out airstrikes on a target in Lebanon. It was just south of the capital, Beirut. Israeli officials say they targeted a terror site the day after missiles were launched from Lebanon into Israel. 35 people have been arrested in the Indian city of Mumbai after a woman was raped by a group of five men. The 23-year-old photojournalist was working in the city when she was attacked, and a man with her was beaten. The families of those killed in a hostage crisis in the Philippines 3 years ago are to sue the country's government. Survivors from Hong Kong are demanding an apology and compensation 3 years after a sacked Filipino policeman seized a bus packed with tourists. Eight people died, seven were injured when police moved to end the standoff. And efforts are continuing to contain a massive wildfire in California, which has been burning close to the Yosemite National Park for a week. On Thursday, the fire tripled in size. There are now 1,300 firefighters tackling the blaze. Tourists have been evacuated and thousands of homes are threatened. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Clemency Burton-Hill.
Now, here on Monocle 24 this summer, we've been thinking a lot about how Switzerland often gets overlooked for its Italian neighbour when it comes to great food, beautiful landscape, fantastic hotels, and things like cutting-edge film festivals. And what about when it comes to music? The sleepy, tiny medieval town of Saint-Pré in Switzerland might not be the place you'd expect to find the boldest and most innovative programming when it comes to mixing classical music with dance, opera and cutting-edge contemporary architecture. But with the Saint-Pré Classics Festival that opened this week, that's exactly what you get.
Yes, it is. Well, who better to discuss what the Saint-Pré Festival is trying to achieve than the director of the event herself, Hazeline Van Sway. She's on the line with us now. Thanks for joining us this morning. Perhaps you could start, we'll get into all sorts of extraordinary details about your festival, but perhaps you could tell us exactly what you're trying to achieve. What's the philosophy?
Well, the philosophy is to have a very different festival where we bring together top international artists from different fields like opera, ballet, and chamber music, and get them to create very special performances for Saint-Pré. We have a unique setting because it's an old medieval village for whom we have now created an extension built by the Swiss, or designed by the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. So it's really a very different festival because there's a unique setting and there's unique programming.
Hazeline, in the programming you have attracted some of the world's top artists to the festival, which is in itself a huge coup given that the festival hasn't been going on for very many years and it's not as widely known as, say, the Proms or Aix-en-Provence or the Salzburg Festival. You have huge competition each summer and yet you've managed to create these amazing programs with these heavyweight artists such as Nigel Kennedy or Anne-Sophie von Otter. What do you think is attracting them to Saint-Pré? Is it the fact that they get to take artistic risks there that they can't take elsewhere?
I think it's the two things. I think it's the setting. The artists love this new contemporary stage infrastructure that is really an extension of this old medieval village. So they love the setting. They love the acoustics that we have in there. And then, yes, it's an opportunity to do something different, to collaborate with artists, great artists that they would otherwise never meet. And but some artists aren't open to that, and the ones that are open to that are the ones that come to Saint-Pré.
I wonder, given that we have talked a bit on Monocle 24 about the idea around the world of Switzerland, the reputation it has, and that reputation might be something a little bit sleepy, a little bit conservative. What you're doing isn't conservative at all, is it? Are you pleased that you're sort of busting stereotypes?
I think I don't really think of it that way. I think of it that I like to do what interests me and what motivates me, and that's why I can get up the energy to do all this. And I like taking things and like people out of their comfort zones. And I think what we do here, and it gives a fantastic electricity to the performances. We had Vadim Repin and Svetlana Zakharova on stage together for the very first time the day before yesterday and on Tuesday. And this was just fantastic. They're a man and wife in life. For the first time ever, they came together on stage. You've got the best ballerina, or one of the best ballerinas in the world at the moment, one of the best violinists. I mean, it was fantastic.
And to give us a sense, I mean, I know the festival's running still for a while. What are the highlights that are still to come in Saint-Pré?
So the highlights that we have still to come are this evening. We have Anne-Sophie Von Otter, who will be on stage with Pepe Linhart Big Band, and Paul Meyer on the clarinet. So it'll be a crossover program of, you know, Ellington, Basie, Benny Goodman, that type of music. And I think it's fantastic that Anne-Sophie Von Otter, you know, lends herself and her beautiful voice to that. We have John Malkovich coming in a special program bringing together the world of theater acting with the world of opera. And it's a musical play, really, where John is a serial killer who kills his victims with their bras, and the victims are the sopranos, and there's an orchestra on stage, so it's very much in our type of ADN or DNA. We have Nigel Kennedy and Richard Galliano on stage together for the very first time. So these are unique collaborations that we create.
What's also unique is that environment, that visual environment. I mean, how important is this kind of striking mix of old and new in the architecture? I mean, how does that feed into the atmosphere, do you think?
I think it's very essential. When I had the idea of asking the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology to develop this new stage infrastructure for us, it was really to bring a fourth dimension to the festival. We have the dimension of chamber music, of opera, of ballet, and now we brought architecture to it. And I think it's very, very important, or at least for me it's important, when I go to a concert, when I go to a performance, if the whole environment, if you have a whole, it becomes a whole experience. So it's really from the moment you come to this beautiful medieval village, the foyer is in the main street, and then you go under the old drawbridge tower, over the stage, into the arena, and then you get a beautiful performance. So from the moment you park your car till the moment you take it to leave, it's a whole experience, and that for me is very important.
Hazeline, I don't know if it's the same in Switzerland, but there's a lot of doom and gloom, particularly around the classical music, opera, dance worlds here in the UK, where people feel that younger audiences are not attracted to those art forms, that it's very difficult to refresh an audience. How important is it that in continuing to push boundaries and indeed undermine the boundaries that are set up between different art forms as you're doing in those sorts of collaborations, how important do you think it is in terms of showing a new audience that actually classical music, dance, opera, literature, theatre, these could be absolutely thrilling to younger and a different audience as well?
I think that's very, very important. I think what we are doing here does just that. You get crossover audiences because you're mixing artists from different domains. So, for instance, you will get the ballet audience for Svetlana Zakharova, and all of a sudden they discover a violinist like Vadim Repin. So that is one important element in bringing new audiences to the different domains of the classical world. And then the second one, which I think is really important, is that the younger generation, they do not think, or they somehow, you know, to push the door of an opera house or a concert hall would not come to their mind. But if you are in an environment like Saint-Pré, which is fun, we've got jazz bands playing in the street before, it's a discovery. And so this both things help to attract a new audience.
Well, Hazeline, I know the festival runs until September the 1st. We wish you the very best of luck with the rest of it. And certainly, I mean, I can't think of another festival in Europe that's been anything quite so innovative. So we wish you the very best of it. Thank you very much for joining us here on Monocle 24. Hazeline Van Sway, the director of the Saint-Pré Classics Music Festival in Switzerland.
Are you going to be able to make it over there? You're very excited about it.
I am. I'm really excited about it. Well, I'm rather tied up in my own music festival in London, which is a small matter of the proms this week. So it's tricky, but I would love to go over there. I'm looking at the pictures and just thinking, and it sounds extraordinary. So
pesky proms
maybe
getting in your
year.
Way, huh?
Maybe next year.
Okay, you are listening to Midori House. After this, we'll find out how a solar laptop might revolutionise technology in Africa.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time it was seen with disdain, but over the years that culture had gotten so popular it's iconic now.
If you're serving decent food in East London, I don't think you've got any problem getting custom in. And I worked in the West End for years, you know, I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
This is Midori House. It is 8:41 in London, but 7:41 a.m. in Bamako, Mali.
And it's time now to turn to our Mali correspondent. Joining us on the line from Bamako is our woman there, Alex Duval-Smith. Good morning, Alex.
Morning.
Thanks very much for being with us. Now, let's start with what's been happening. What happened yesterday in Mali?
Well, the big news yesterday was actually came out of Mauritania with the announcement of two Islamist groups merging. The leaders of the former leader of AFKIM, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, joining Mujahid, which are the two probably most prominent Islamist groups that were involved in the war that France fought earlier this year. And France, of course, still has 3,000 troops here to sort of push the Islamists back into the desert. They've they announced on the Mauritanian news agency ANI that they're creating a new group called the Murabitoun to achieve the unity of Muslims from the Nile to the Atlantic. And the figurehead, if you like, or the person whose name's most recognizable is Mokhtar Belmokhtar, known as the one-eyed man, or as the French call him, the uncatchable. Locally, he's known as Mr. Marlborough because he smuggles cigarettes. That's his big thing. That's what he used to do before he started abducting human beings.
Indeed.
The United States has offered a $5 million bounty for his capture. He's one of the big figures sort of concerned by this merger.
And he has obviously played a significant part in the last few months. It's been 8 months since that military intervention. We've had presidential elections since then. So this announcement from Mauritania was sounding pretty ominous then.
Well, I think it depends how you look at it. I mean, it could be either a sign of the individual groups having been weakened, as France claims, as a result of the intervention, or what they'd like it to sound as, which is an expression of strength. The two groups have worked together before in Niger in May when they launched a joint suicide mission against a military target in Niger and against a French uranium mine. So they've worked together before. On the other hand, I think it's worth bearing in mind that we're living in times leading up to the 11th of September anniversary, and the U.S. has warned of a threat in the region, heightened security in its embassies. Islamists also threatened to disrupt last month's Malian elections and never did. So this could be a lot of saber rattling. I think one has to be very aware of the publicity nature of both sides, actually, both what the Americans are saying and what's going on here in the desert. The truth is that it's very, very hard to know how strong the Islamist groups still are. French troops are still finding arms caches in the desert, they're telling us, and still destroying them. If they're doing it at a rate, the rate that they appear to be doing it, then they are destroying a considerable arsenal of vehicles and guns and suicide vest-making factories, as they call them, and gradually having an impact on these groups.
Alex, let's completely switch tactics now and talk about African technology and talk about a Canadian-made solar-powered laptop with 10 hours battery life, which has been launched this week in Ghana. That sounds extremely positive.
Yeah, I mean, one is always very wary of sort of talking about African technological breakthroughs, because so often they sort of are extremely good ideas that come to nothing because the funding is not there. But this time, there are actually two or three worth mentioning. This one that's been launched this week in Ghana is called Sol, made by Canadian company Wewe, and they're a specialists in security technology and very, very used to working in the African environment, which involves, of course, which requires equipment with very, you know, very sturdy equipment that can withstand working in high temperatures, as I often find to my cost. And being solar powered is almost an obvious solution. So Sol is a competitor, if you like, to a Samsung notebook that's existing, and the XO laptops, which are being given out by Bill Gates' One Laptop Per Child program. But this one's a little bit more cutting edge. It's got 4G and Bluetooth. It will retail for $400, which is a very low price, on a 320-gigabyte hard drive. I mean, what I spot as sort of the drawback there is it's running on Linux. You know, Linux is this sort of free-for-all software, which, having tried to use it myself, unless you're very good at computers, is a complete nightmare. And this seems to happen often in Africa. You know, people come up with a great idea, and then they give it to a continent which has hardly any technological expertise and ask them to work out Linux. It's just not a good plan. But looking into it, I sort of found it quite interesting to discover that there are two or three other products that are sort of African-born and which are up and running already. Morocco already has its own homegrown laptop, the Accent, made by an entrepreneur called Karim Mazouzi in Casablanca. He has a factory with 100 employees. It started as a factory to assemble Dells and Toshibas, and for the last 3 or 4 years, it's been making 20,000 a year of its own brand laptops, the Accent, and wisely, again, as with Sol, aiming to sell them to institutional clients like the Ministry of Education, NGOs, international organizations, so securing large orders before going to the mass public, which of course requires, you know, a marketing budget, which perhaps these people don't have. And then there's Congo Brazzaville has come up with its own tablet, and this made a lot of noise a couple of years ago. The Way C, it's known as Way C, means starlight in one of the Congolese languages, and that has been designed by a computer engineer, Véron Mankou, and is made in China, which you could say is a drawback, but it's still pretty good going to design a tablet, take it over to China, make it at a competitive price, and sell it then for the equivalent of €228 in a large number of the mobile phone shops in Congo Brazzaville, which gives it, you know, quite a reach.
Alex, thank you for that technological tour of a continent. Wonderful. Good luck keeping your laptop cool as well. Our woman in Bamako, Mali, is Alex Duval-Smith.
Well, we're about to read through the British front pages with our news editor, Tom Edwards. But first, let's have a quick song, shall we?
That was The Night Six with Thinking of You. And you are listening to Midori House with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Clemency Burton Hill. If you can hear a slight rustling in the background, that's not... You see, it was slight. Now it's ridiculous over-rustling. Tom Edwards is over-rustling the newspapers. He's guiding us through the British press today. How are you, Tom?
I'm very well, thanks, Tom.
I see post-its attached to bits of paper.
Oh, I'm pretty well organised.
Yeah.
I may over-rustle, but I'm organised.
Yeah. Okay. So where are we starting?
I thought we'd start with this piece in The Independent by Ian Burrell, a media editor, of course, of The Indian, a regular contributor to Monocle 24, about Kevin Spacey's McTaggart lecture he's delivering at in Edinburgh, obviously at the International Television Festival. He's used this as a platform. He's the first actor, I think, to deliver the keynote address. It's usually more of sort of industry insiders. And he's been talking about his disappointment with the television industry in this country and, to be honest, around the world. And he cites some of his recent successes. A lot of people obviously will be familiar with the House of Cards remake.
I haven't seen it, but I
excellent show.
It was a good plug for House of Cards, this speech, I thought.
Yeah, it was. But I think the point he was making more broadly was he, along with the other producers, sort of touted the show around a lot of the big networks and no one would give them the time of day. Only Netflix, who ended up producing the show, said commissioned it on the basis they wouldn't need a pilot. And he was talking about a lack of boldness, a lack of willingness to support new talent. And I thought it was quite interesting.
And this wasn't just sour grapes on his part in terms of like, oh, Liabu sucks, you didn't take it and now look at you. I mean, presumably there's a serious point to be made here.
Absolutely.
About the sort of rise and rise of streaming box set culture, the fact that people want to watch on demand something. I mean, but there's an issue, isn't there? Because clearly television itself, if that's what people want to watch, won't die. But
no,
the way in which it's disseminated, the way in which people make
exactly
it and
right.
produce it is,
I mean,
the key.
Because he sort of, and he makes this point, he's saying if there's an appetite for people to watch basically an entire season of a new show in one day, which obviously a lot of people did with the House of Cards show, for example, he's saying, you know, that shows they've got the attention span, it shows they're motivated, it shows they're engaged with gripping new content.
Or they've just got really
maybe the
nothing
industry.
Better to do with their
well,
lives.
That of course is true.
I feel his point is slightly undermined by the fact, if he's talking about, you know, promoting originality and taking a risk on something unproven, The House of Cards was a remake of a British show.
Damn,
after
you're
all.
Such a cynic.
Sorry, Kevin.
Why do you have to be this way?
I'm just saying.
I'm disappointed by your reaction to that, Dom.
Okay, well, I think it is
an
interesting article, nonetheless.
There is a serious case to be made about the
exactly.
complacency in old-fashioned television as it stands.
Don't know why I'm defending the
now,
networks.
Can I move on?
Weird.
Can I move on and talk about complacency of a different kind yes. in the printed media here in this country? And Dom, I believe you actually have a view on this.
I better have one now.
It's a staple feature of our newspapers across the spectrum, to be honest, in this country, that on exam results day, the papers splash pictures of happy high achievers waving their many A grades in the
yes,
air, saying,
do.
Hooray, hooray. I wanted to pick out in particular the Daily Telegraph, who've managed to achieve what is for them the perfect storm for this
it's like
kind
it's,
of piece.
It's like they've got a lab underneath Telegraph Towers and finally it's produced the ultimate picture story.
It's a big picture of said celebrating GCSE student, except in this case, it's Isabella Soames, great-granddaughter, of course, of Sir Winston Churchill from the famous Soames family. She's also now going to do A-levels and be a model, so they can do loads of puns like model pupil.
Good.
And I just think I'm going to have a pop at our media for constantly using these terrible, hackneyed, cliched images. How about that, Dom? Do you agree
well,
with that?
Well, there's a visual shorthand for certain things, isn't there? And unfortunately, we cannot get away, and TV is as guilty, I think, as print. The visual shorthand for GCSE results day is, if possible, they can be twins. If possible, they can be sort of, you know, blonde, pretty girls. Let's put them on the front
I
of the newspaper.
I don't agree. I think often I think as well, if you can find the Asian genius, not to make a point about, you know, certain cultural types doing better than others. Precocious 9-year-old who got an A star in maths.
That's definitely a subgenre of the GCSE.
Because, of course, when it comes to A-levels, no one's actually interested in the pretty girls with straight A stars. They're interested in the people that you might, or society, particularly in the Daily Telegraph, Daily Mail, let's say, might not have expected to get straight A stars, who've been turned down inevitably by Oxford and Cambridge, but who got 5 A's at A-level and wanting
it.
To be a doctor and who escaped a war-torn conflict and come to England 18 months ago with no English.
But this is it. We're writing these stories. This will appear every results day, every year, without fail. And I just think, come on, guys.
Yeah. Get a new story.
Telegraph's
let's
waiting
get some
for the
originality.
Sort of the horse-riding Siamese albino
exactly.
twins.
Let's up the stakes a little.
Also, what we should be talking about, the fact it's so depressing that, okay, fine, this girl's got 11 A-star grades. That's fantastic for her. No one would take away from her achievement. But actually, literacy in this country is declining. Numeracy in this country is declining. There are so many areas of our education policy that need really
we should be thinking about doing anything but celebrate.
Now, that is front page news. Why isn't there the appetite? I think people want to read about that as well.
Especially if it's tempered by, okay, that's great. A lot of kids have done really well, although GCSE results are down again this year, as were A-level results. But, you know, either way, that's a media story. When they're up every year, everyone goes, oh, why are they up every year? When they're down every year, goes, oh, why are they down?
What I was quite pleased about is that modern languages have actually gone up for reversing a sort of somewhat terminal decline. I think maybe the decline was reversed last year, but in this country, particularly if we're planning on being a sort of a talking, exporting nation, we need to be able to talk languages, don't we?
By the way, I just found English.
In the inside of the Times newspaper, Little Einstein 9 gets a star in maths.
We were going to get around to him eventually.
Yeah.
But he's only inside. He doesn't make the same splash as Isabel Soames, though.
Abhinav Santhiramotham from Luton. He studied for only 9 months and he got an A star in maths and he's 9 years old.
That's insufferable. There you go. See, what's he doing next? Is he going to Oxford University?
He's going to be somebody special in the future. And says his mother, I'm so proud of my little boy, he's a little Einstein.
I think we shouldn't be cynical about it.
He's
going to be a special little boy.
Hang on, there is also the big story of people who don't get any GCSEs. There you go.
So
maybe we're being a bit...
There's an expose we should have. What happens to people
with
no
exams?
Well,
there is a leader in the Times about kids who don't get any GCSEs.
They're buried on page 17. Oh, well, fair enough. So I shouldn't have besmirched the Times in with all the others as well, should I?
I can see you've got more.
Well, now, you know that I always like to have an animal-related story.
I fear that you often do, yeah.
How do you feel about this? I can't quite do justice to this, because this is radio, after all. No. This is in The Guardian. They have their big eyewitness spread. They're down in Rye, in East Sussex. I was down there myself recently. Quite charming. And they've got a wonderful sort of photo essay about the British Trust for Ornithology, who are recording bird avian movements. And here, in their main picture, look, a chiff-chaff.
Wow.
Having his wings inspected. This is my personal favourite, though. I remember a warbler being weighed inside a ringing hut at Rye. I don't know if you can see this picture.
I've always wondered how you weigh a warbler.
It looks a bit like it's about to be fired out of a tiny cannon in some kind of circus attraction.
Performing
but actually,
bird.
That's how you weigh them. They catch them in nets. They're marked. They keep them to subdue them, because it's quite stressful.
Oh, no.
They keep them in a small Hessian sack.
And that because they can't see anything. That
well, no, it's the classic, but it's like, you know, the old parrot chatty. Put the little thing over its head.
Yeah.
Off to sleep it goes. Anyway, a beautiful photo essay. So
it is lovely.
Do have a glance.
Bird
if you get
in the hand. I believe that's worth two in the bush, isn't it?
Oh,
absolutely.
You too.
That's a yellow
card. That's definitely all we've got time for today. Enough, Dominic and Tom.
Okay.
Tom Edwards, our news editor, thank you very much for that scintillating pay-per-view, as always. I'm afraid that really is all we have time for today. Thanks very much to our producer, Daphne Denis, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Ilya Simos, and our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Up next after the news is Section D. I'll be back with Phil Hand from Midori House at the same time on Monday, but from now, from me, Clemency Burton Hill.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.